Good morning. It is great to see you. Welcome to MCC, especially if you're joining us here for the very first time. We're thrilled to have you. If you're watching on Facebook Live, we're thrilled to have you as well. We are now a week into 2017, and we're actually going to kick off our first series of the year, and it's a series called Defined. It's about the mission and values that shape our community. And one of the ways I like to talk about this is we're not going to talk about who we are in this series as much as we're going to talk about who we hope to be. The kind of community we're always striving to be, because in all the ways we do it, sometimes we fall short of some of these values that really, really matter. And so we're going to start today by looking at our mission as a church, which shouldn't be news. If you've ever looked at that wall back there, it's there regularly. We're going to talk about our values as well. So over the next 5 weeks, we're going to talk about honoring the image of God in every single human being. We're going to talk about how important it is to be in community with others, and how that community, the way we talk about it, is transformative community, that when we're in meaningful relationships, it does something to us that can't happen outside of meaningful relationships. We're going to talk about missional engagement, how there's this whole wide world out there outside of these walls that we're being invited to engage with. And we've talked so much about faith not being just a bunch of beliefs, or not just something you watch and spectate, but that faith actually is something you're being invited to participate in for the betterment of the world. Like, there's a whole world out there, and we've been invited to be a part of it. And then the last week of this series, we're going to talk about creating a faith that makes sense for the head and the heart, because I know so many of people I talk to are in situations where they don't feel like their faith that they grew up with, or maybe the categories they were given and the doctrines they were given, like, they just don't make sense anymore. And they're being asked, I feel like I'm way down, there we go. And we're being asked to either jettison sort of the thing that matters to our heads, or we're being asked to let go of the things that matter to our hearts. And one of the things we're finding is there's actually this middle space where that you can actually bring those two together in a really beautiful way, meaningful way. And that being a person who's engaging the mind doesn't mean you can't be a person also of deep feeling and connection with the bigness of everything and with other human beings as well. So that's what we're going to be exploring. And so I want to begin with our mission statement. We do this every January. We do some sort of series like this where we explore this. So if this is your second January, you're hearing this in a different way for a second time. But if you've joined us since last January, these themes are going to be familiar because we work them into pretty much everything we do. We talk about this stuff all the time, but not always explicitly. So, and when I say explicit, I don't mean like when the rap records came out in the 90s and your parents wouldn't let you buy it because it said explicit at the bottom. How do you remember this? Like, you would sneak in the rap record. Yeah, I'm not talking about that kind of explicit. We'll see what happens. But I'm talking generally about like just saying it. I want to say the thing and invite you to be a part of it over these next several weeks. So here's our mission as a church, as a community. We exist to empower people to take the next step on their journey with Christ. Now, that's somewhat ambiguous intentionally. It's intentional that we don't say we exist to tell everybody what to believe. Right? One of the things that makes our community, I think, unique is that we invite people wherever they are on their journey, whatever beliefs they hold, to be in this community and to be in tension with people who disagree. I know some of you disagree with me. We give you all the space you need to be wrong. That's why we're here, right? You have all the space in the world to be wrong. And I have all the space in the world to be wrong, because what binds us together ultimately is not our shared beliefs. It's a shared journey. That we're all on this process and a part of this transformation. And people are central to our mission, right? We don't exist for buildings and bureaucracies. And we exist because you and I, as human beings, we need one another. And we need to be empowered to be told that our journey matters, to be told that it's okay to question, it's okay to doubt, it's okay to be a part of this whole messy process. And the central thing about this mission recognizes that absolutely every single human being is on a journey. And if you sum this up in sort of a shorter phrase, I would say this: our mission is movement. Our mission is movement. It's about being on the move, which is actually not a new idea in human history. What people who study this tell us is that around 200,000 years ago, how many of you remember this happening? Anybody? Anybody there? Yeah. Around 200,000 years ago, our ancient human ancestors, so after we left behind, you know, there were other human sort of ancestors, the people who most resemble us today, left southern Africa and went up into the Middle East in what was really the first human migration. And when they went up to the Middle East, some of them went left. It's sort of like the scarecrow in the Wizard of Oz. Some people go that way. And when they went left, they went into Europe. And some people went right, and they went into the East, into Asia. And eventually, they went everywhere else, right? And there's this human migration. People have been on the move, and it still happens. How many of you have ever moved? Like, how many of you moved from one city to another? from one country to another. Right? How many of you have moved down the block? I remember when I was in high school, we didn't move until I was 11, and we moved across the street. And then, actually, no. Yes, we moved across the street. And then my dad decided, and my mom decided we need to move again, so we moved back across the street. And then eventually, we were living in some apartments, and literally, we moved from one apartment to the other like 3 or 4 times. Like, it was just moving back and forth. I'm used to movement. And there's this sense of human beings. We're used to movement. We're used to being on the move, on the go. Most of us have lived multiple places. How many of you remember your very first address? Anybody remember your first address? Yeah, we have the ability to remember multiple places we've lived and all the web of relationships we formed. Human history is still a story of migration, of movement, of people leaving one place and going to another. But it's not just the human story. It's also the story of our faith tradition. If you pick up a copy of the Bible and read it, what you'll find is that from the beginning, people are on the move. The story of, really the Jewish story kickstarts, the Jewish Christian story kickstarts with a guy named Abraham, who is told by God to do what? Move. Go. Leave your family, leave your ancestry, leave the faith of your ancestry, and go to a place I will show you. And so Abraham picks up and he moves. A bit later, Abraham's family ends up in Egypt. They move from Canaan to Egypt. And when they're in Egypt, they end up being enslaved by the Egyptians. But God sends a man named Moses to liberate the people, and they come out of Egypt in what's known as the Exodus. So another movement. But then they go into the wilderness, into the desert, and they wander for a really long time. 40 years they spend just walking around the desert. And you know somebody's going, would you just stop and ask directions? Like, please, it's been 40 years. And it's been 40 years in the desert. And then there's another movement. After they come back, after they get their own land, they're taken out of the land. And it's called the exile. And then they return from exile. And then Jesus comes on the scene. And Jesus' first essential message when he calls disciples, anybody know what it was? Follow me, which follow is a word of movement. And Jesus and his little ragtag band of disciples, they walk around all over the Galilee, like just continually from place to place in movement. And of course, the early church begins in the city of Jerusalem, but very soon it spreads out from Jerusalem to the surrounding areas, and eventually it becomes a global movement. Now, what's interesting about all this movement is at every stage, there is a rethinking of God, a rethinking of what we mean by the word God and what this thing we call God, what this being, whatever we call God, is actually like. Abraham is invited to rethink God from a culture of polytheism with lots of gods, gods who would demand you offer your child as a sacrifice. Right? The story of Abraham binding Isaac isn't a story of this biblical God asking him to kill his son. It's a story of this God saying, will you leave behind these old ways of seeing God? And will you move into a more generous understanding of God's love and compassion, that God actually doesn't need you to sacrifice your kids on an altar? Right? This was a movement from one way of seeing God to another. In the Exodus story, we're invited to see God very differently than most people had seen God up to that point. And even today, most people believe that God is on the side of who? The people at the top of the pyramid, the people at the top of the ladder, the top of the food chain, right? Because we often use this language. Like when you think about people with tons of money and tons of power who are in charge of governments, we say God has really what? Blessed them. But Jesus comes along and says, blessed are the poor. And what the Exodus story reveals is God isn't on the side of wealth and power, unless wealth and power is on the side of the poor. God is on the side of the poor. God is on the side of the slaves. God is a liberating God. And in the Exodus story, God, the Hebrew people flip the narrative about God on its ear and say, actually, we found God is not for wealth and power and dominance. God is for compassion and forgiveness and rescue. That's what God's like. Then in exile, here's what the people find out in exile. They had built an empire, very much like Egypt, where they had slaves doing their labor, and they were mistreating the poor and the widow and the orphan. And what the Jewish prophets say is, you know what? This exile is going to make us rethink God completely, because what we've forgotten is the very thing that brought us out of Egypt. God is on the side of the poor, and you're not on God's side unless you're on the side of the poor. And my goodness, Jesus really brought us to a drastic rethinking of God. From this violent being in the sky who would sometimes come down to bless us and sometimes come down to give us flat tires, right? Like that sort of thing. Jesus invites us to radically rethink God, a God who isn't somewhere else, but a God who's right here, a God in whom we live, move, and exist, a God who surrounds us like a fish in water, a God who is love, a God who is compassion, a God who is on the side of the marginalized and the broken and the hurting, a God who is not impressed with religious ritual, but a God who is deeply moved by compassion, because that's what God is like. Jesus, at every stage of this migration, we've been invited to think about God differently. And for the early church, as they begin their movement, my goodness, talk about being confused. Talk about having to learn some new categories, right? Because their entire life, they've been told Gentiles were bad and impure and evil. Their entire lives, they'd missed the goodness of bacon. And they're being invited to be in community with people who they once thought were untouchable. That's a little bit of rethinking, isn't it? And I bring this up because I think that movement, which is implicit in the human story and implicit in the biblical story, is still a valid experience for us today. I think we just have this imagination of the Bible where we say, and everything ended at the last period, right? In the book of Revelation, which actually wasn't the last book written, but that's a whole other talk. When the Bible was done and somebody put it in leather binding and gilded edges and put your name on it, that the whole movement thing was over. But what I think Christians have found for thousands of years now is that the movement continues, right? There's an author named Phyllis Tickle. She's a brilliant woman. She passed away a couple years ago. She was in her 80s, and she was sort of one of the catalysts for the emerging church, right? She was one of the catalysts for this new way of thinking about God. And she says that about every 500 years, there's been upheaval in Christian tradition, right? So every 500 years, something big happens. And about the first 500 years, you had the church councils that were going on, and they were arguing over things that really don't think make much sense to us today. And then about another 500 years in, you had some more upheaval. Then at the year 1500, where actually this year makes the anniversary of this, Martin Luther, who was a really genuinely bad guy, I think, not very nice. If you go to Martin Luther insult generator, it takes little sections out of his writing and gives you random insults to people. So, I mean, that's something you could do with your spare time if you wanted. But Luther nailed his 95 theses to the Wittenberg church door, and Protestantism began, right? So essentially the point is, throughout church history, we've still been experiencing movement. Movement is essential to what we're doing and what we're about. Here's what Brian McLaren says in his latest book, The Great Spiritual Migration. I've come to see that what matters most is not our status, but our trajectory. Not where we are, but where we're going. Not where we stand, but where we're headed. Christian faith for me is no longer a static location, but a great spiritual journey. As I see it, religion is at its best when it leads us forward, when it guides our spiritual growth as individuals and in our cultural evolution as a species. Unfortunately, religion often becomes more of a cage than a guide, holding us back rather than summoning us onward, a buffer to constructive change rather than the catalyst for it. How many of you have experienced religion in that way? The way I would talk about it is spiritual claustrophobia. Has anybody ever experienced claustrophobia? Just in there, how many of you in this room are claustrophobic? Oh, we should have done something fun with that. That could have been interesting to see what would happen if we'd made a little box and made you get in it or something. Interesting. Anyway, I have a little bit of that, right? If you've ever been in like an MRI machine and you're told to lay still and all you can hear is yourself breathing and you panic a bit, yeah. I mean, if you've ever been in any sort of situation where you're claustrophobic and the walls close in, you know that sense of panic. I think lots and lots of people experience spiritual claustrophobia in the sense that we have been sort of taught that the truest expression of faith is to stay in the same spot, right? It was good enough for Paul. It was good enough for Grandpa. It was good enough. It's good enough. How many of you have kind of heard that before? And you've been in a religious situation where somebody says this: we've always believed it this way. How many of you have ever said that yourself as you're trying to eschew somebody who's trying to rock the boat a little bit? I used to say that to people. I was like 20. Like, we've always believed this way. Like, you don't even shave, man. What are you talking about? We've always believed this way. But there's we have this idea that if we just stay in the same spot and we're static and nothing ever changes, then that's what God's looking for, right? And in reality, for most of us, we have this sense of spiritual claustrophobia because if you're paying attention, then a lot of times what's going to happen when you're confronted with people, when you're confronted with situations, when you're confronted with a world that isn't nice and neat and doesn't line up really well, you're going to start having questions. And when you've not been given space to ask those questions, you have very few options. And some of your options are, if I can't do this, I'm feeling so claustrophobic, I'm out. Right? I'm done with the whole thing. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to be told what to believe. I'm not going to be told what to do. I'm done. And I really believe that's a real condition that many of us struggle with. We've been given this curiosity. We've been given this beautiful world with so many different people in it, and we bump into them, and we were like, I was told I had to hate all of, like, there are a billion Christians. I was told I had to hate, like, 6 billion other people on the planet. And then you meet not all 6 billion at once. That's like speed dating on, you know, steroids. But you meet people. You bump into people. You hear stories about people. People whose skin is different than yours. People who wear different clothing than you because of their religious tradition. You bump into people who are different. And you begin to realize, my goodness, I have more questions about this world than I have answers. And when you're not given space to ask them, it begins to knot you up a bit. I think if I could describe my former view of God, it would be that God was behind us, always trying to pull us back to some ideal period. Right? And everybody has that ideal time. And it's not just about religion. If you were to ask any true West Virginia fan who knows God more deeply and intimately in prayer than any other sports team, and shaking fists at the sky, you'll find out that the period of 2005, 6, and 7 was really the golden era. And everything is measured by that standard. All right? How many you guys know what I'm talking about? You have that, and we even have that in families, right? I look at my family situation, and I remember Christmas before my grandfather died, and now after my grandfather died, it's just not the same anymore. And so you kind of, when you go back to that idyllic period. And when you are a religious person, you always look back. Like, do you remember when the church did this? Do you remember this period in our church history? Wasn't that really the best? We should go back to that. That's not unique to us, the Israelites. Fresh out of slavery, we're going, the food was better in Egypt. Should we just go back? Like, should we, like, they had better takeout. Should we go back? There's this, and I do not believe that is the pull of the divine pulling us backward. I believe that is the fear of the human heart, because I believe the divine is ahead of us pulling us forward. I do not believe when people made ridiculous arguments from the Bible to defend slavery and white supremacy, I do not believe God was behind them going, yes, let's go back to that. I think God has always been ahead of us going, what are you doing? Let's go. I don't believe when people use the Bible to say women can't lead, that God's behind us going, yes, put her in her place. I believe God, because she's ahead of us. And I believe God is pulling us forward, saying, of course there's equality between men and women. Of course women are equipped to lead and to serve. Of course, of course, of course. I think God has always been ahead of us, saying, let's get this thing going. And it's been our resistance to the movement, not God pulling us backward. It's been our fear of change that has kept us from experiencing the fullness of life that comes from saying yes to moving forward. Does that make sense? I think God has always, always, always been ahead of us. And I think there's just a different way of seeing God. A God who, we have this sort of image of God that God occasionally pops in and bippity-boppity-boos us. You know what I mean? Like, you were this person, and then you go down front at church and you pray a prayer, and God goes poof, and suddenly you're somebody you never were. Right? That's kind of what I was taught happened. You have this experience, you cry a little bit, and God shows up like your fairy godmother, bippity-boppity-boo, and you're ready for the ball, right? Like, that's, but what you discover is that's not how it works. There is no divine dump truck that gets backed up to you the moment you pray a prayer and goes, beep, 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 goodness, compassion, kindness, pff, all over you, right? That's not how it works. When God changes us, it's through a process. It's through years and years of growing, of being confronted with old ways of seeing that need to be let go and being invited into new ways, of being invited to see the world a little bit differently. I don't think God just pops in. And you may be wondering, yeah, that's great, but is this even supported anywhere in the Bible? That's a great question. I want to look at a story from Mark chapter 8. And this is Jesus and his disciples. They're in a place called Bethsaida. And there's a blind man who's been brought to Jesus. And just, if you, how many of you have ever read a story about Jesus giving a sight to a blind person before. You read these stories? I bet if you've read this story, you've been like me as I've read it all my life. This is the first time I've ever used it in a sermon because I had no idea what to do with it, right? It's a weird story. Jesus and his disciples came to Bethsaida. Some people brought a blind man to Jesus and begged him to touch and heal him. Taking the blind man's hand, Jesus led him out of the village. After spitting on his eyes, now, right away, this is an intrusion on space. Would you agree? Like, can you imagine if you're the guy going, could you just heal me, and you hear this? Like, I'm not quite sure that's part of the healing experience. I didn't sign up to be in the splash zone at SeaWorld. Like, I just want to see, right? Like, that's sort of that sort of. So Jesus takes him out, hocks a loogie, spits on the guy, and puts his hand on his eyes. Thank God for hand sanitizer these days. You know, and Jesus asked the man, do you see anything? And notice the guy's response. He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees, only they are walking around. Have you guys seen Lord of the Rings? Would that not trip you out in like the first century? Like people like trees? Here's the point. Jesus spits on the guy, touches him. Do you see anything? The guy's like, ish. I see things, ish. I sort of see things. I think those are people, or else the world's gotten strange. They look like people, look like trees. Jesus placed his hands on the man's eyes again. He looked with his eyes wide open. His sight was restored, and he could see everything clearly. What's interesting about this story? How many of you read this story before? How many of you read it and ended with, hubba what? Like, was Jesus not feeling the mojo that day? Like, what? Why in the world does it take twice? I think this is an invitation for us to see the process of transformation, because I think most of us would say that line, I once was blind, you know, but now I'm seeing a bit better. Like, I think there's something to that. And I think there's something about this story that's inviting us to see that this is how transformation really happens. It isn't bippity-boppity-boo. It is a process of having your eyes touched again and again and again. And perhaps every time your eyes are touched, you begin to see a little more clearly. You guys know that I'm a U2 super fan, and I find Bono to just be an inspiring human being, and I ran across this quote from him. I've heard of people having life-changing, miraculous turnarounds, people set free from addiction after a single prayer, relationships saved when both parties let go and let God, but it was not like that for me. For all that I was lost, I am found, it is probably more accurate to say I was really lost. I'm a little less so at the moment. And then a little less, and a little less again. That, to me, is the spiritual life, the slow reworking and rebooting of a computer at regular intervals, reading the small print of the service manual. It has slowly rebuilt me in a better image. It has taken years, though, and it is not over yet. For all that I once was lost, but now I'm found, perhaps what we should really say is, I was really lost, and now I'm a little less lost than I was yesterday. And maybe tomorrow I'll be a little less lost than I was today. And maybe in 20 years I'll be a little less lost than I am now. The pressure we put on ourselves to get it all right in a moment, I think, is crippling to what we're trying to do in the world. How many of you have ever messed up and you immediately feel guilt because you're supposed to be better? Anybody? Like somebody does something and you lash out at them and then you're like, well, I'm supposed to be better. And then I'm supposed to be just adds more and more guilt. Right? And every time you mess up, you're more, what if we decided, my goodness, I really messed that up. I should not have been that way to that person. I'm going to apologize. And the next time I'm in this situation, I'm going to try to respond better. Right? Because there's a difference in owning what's gone wrong and wallowing in it. There's a difference in saying, I messed up. I was a little lost there. But next time I'm in this situation, I'm going to be a little less lost than I was this time. There's something beautiful, and there's something powerful about being willing to just own that. I've really been fortunate over the past, I guess, almost year to get to know the Martin family, David and Javine, and their son Randall are part of our church. And David and I have been having conversations, and I was like, I really want you to stand up and talk about this at our church. And he said, okay, when do you want me to do it? I said, I want you to do it January 8th. He said, I'm going to be in Florida. We're trying to love him through it. So he's working on his tan today. But he did put a post on Facebook that he'd sent me before he posted it and said, would this be something good? And so I've asked his son, Randall, to come up front and just read David's post so we can experience a bit of his story. So would you welcome Randall as he comes? I almost rolled my ankle on stage.
Don't do that.
You can sit, you can stand, you can twirl, can whatever. Yeah.
Is this like the seat?
Well, no, it's one of many.
Ooh, I like this seat.
I've got it warm.
Why don't you have those back there? All right. So this is my dad's words. I guess I can say ditto for a lot of it, you know. But while sitting here by the fire this morning, draining the last drop of coffee from my cup, I was pondering some of the highlights of the past year. Everything from changing churches to us having our 47th anniversary. Life has really been good to us. We have so much to be thankful for. We did make a change in the church we were attending, mostly due to the granddaughters. We now are attending MCC with them and couldn't be happier. I really didn't know what to expect by attending a non-denominational church. I was raised Baptist and Methodist in traditional types of worship and held leadership roles in both. I have no regrets whatsoever and have so much love for the people we were worshiping with. The one thing I did going to MCC was keep an open mind. I knew things were going to be somewhat different from what I was used to. Well, I was wrong about most of it being different. When we walked in the door, there was such a feeling of love and peacefulness that I can't even attempt to express it to you. I've grown to love the people here as I have at other churches. We have an excellent pastor in Josh Scott. He places so much emphasis on loving each other as Christ loves us. His knowledge of the Bible and its history is amazing to me. I guess the old saying that you can't teach an old dog new tricks is being proven wrong also, because I've learned so much more about the Bible than I ever thought I could. I have been challenged with some of my earlier beliefs, but that just makes me a stronger Christian because it causes me to study more. I'm sure there will be some things that I don't totally agree with, but I don't totally agree with Javine after being married 47 years either.
Do you want to say anything? Since he's not here, it's all you right now. He can't defend himself.
He's probably watching live.
He probably is watching
making
live.
Sure I'm portraying him properly. All in all, it was a good change for us, and I'm hoping for many more years here. One thing I like is everyone is welcome, regardless of your belief or your status in life. I would never ask someone to leave the church they are attending, but if you don't have a church, please come visit us and give us a chance to share the same love with you that I experienced when we came.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So when David sent me that to read, the thing that stood out to me most was this line where he says, I guess that the saying you can't teach an old dog new tricks is being proven wrong. And I think that we get to this point in our lives where that we begin to think that all those days of learning and growth are behind us. And that could be any age you're at. I know people who are, you know, my age, mid-30s, pushing 40, who would have a very different posture on that, and they would say, everything I need to know I learned when I was in, you know, Sunday school or whatever. But what I'm learning is the only limiter to your ability to move isn't your age, and it isn't how much you know about the Bible, and it's none of those things. What the biggest limiter is our fear and our closedness. So often we approach God and we approach the world with just this shut-offness that nothing is going to be able to get through. And what I'm coming to realize is that the greatest thing we can do to have movement in our lives is just to be open. It doesn't mean you accept everything. It doesn't mean you agree with everything. I mean, there are tons of people who don't agree with me, and I don't agree with them, and yet we have great relationships. And we're all growing. And that, to me, seems to be the key. For us, as a community, we are about empowering one another, giving one another space to just take that next right step on the journey. And I really think it's important to say the next right step, because I know in my life, the times I felt like I need to grow 10 steps today, that's impossible, right? That's impossible. What if I just grew one step today? What if I don't worry about who I'm going to be in 10 years? What if I just worry about the kind of person I'm going to go out into the world as tomorrow and deal with him, and then the next day and the next day and the next day, and in 10 years, maybe I'll be a halfway decent human being. With God's help, with your help, maybe I'll be a halfway decent human being. So here's a few questions as we begin to wrap up. I want to just ask, where are you on your journey of transformation? Where are you? Are you stagnant? Are you stalled? Are you experiencing sort of a equilibrium off balance sort of thing where you're starting to ask questions and you're starting to grow and it's terrifying? How many of you in this room that have really grown in the last year, you've also felt really unnerved and nervous and scared about that? Anybody? Yeah. Is that's normal, right? Like, I think if you aren't a little afraid at that sort of like, oh my goodness, so many things are being left behind, so many things are being pulled forward, like you're not paying attention. There's a little bit of nervousness about that. But there's something so life-giving about it at the same time. Where are you on your journey? Are you growing? Are you taking the next step and the next step when they're being invited? Are you engaged? Are you paying attention? Or are you stagnant and still? Are you sort of clutching on to your worldview without any willingness to open your hands to see what else might be given to you? Where are you on your journey? Where are we? And I would say this, are we stagnant? Where? It's important to name that. Where am I stagnant? I'm having a hard time loving blank. And you're wondering who, right? Like right now, you're wondering who. You need to wonder about who you're having a hard time loving. And maybe it's me, and maybe for me it's you. I don't know. But here's what I know. If you're having a hard time loving somebody, what's the next right step? If you're stagnant in that way, if you're stagnant in generosity and you're walking into the world as if everything you've been given is just yours and you're not seeing the need all around you all the time and ways you can partner with God and other people to do good in the world, perhaps you're stagnant. Maybe your compassion is stagnant. You're having a hard time being a compassionate human in the world. Maybe your patience is stagnant. This would be mine. So I'll just do a little confession time. Deb's not in here to hear, and I told you, her, I told you so to me. But how many of you have kids that are doing this bottle flipping thing that's so annoying? Can we just have a moment to just go, ah? So, okay, good. Preach. My kid was sitting in the hallway before church flipping a bottle. I was like, oh my God, you have to stop. It's so annoying. Like, there's sort of like just that vomit dad moment. And Deb comes over to me and she says, can I just give you a little parenting advice? It's like, please. She said, don't major on that stuff. There are really important things for you to tell him to stop doing. That's not one of them. It's like, but it's really annoying, Deb. It's really, really annoying. It's like, maybe, but you can deal. Right, and maybe your patience is broken. My patience is often broken. Where are we stagnant? Where do we need to move forward? And then I would ask this last question. What is the next right thing in whatever? What is the next right thing in your relationships with your partner or your spouse? What is the next right thing in your friendships? What is the next right thing at work? What is the next right thing in whatever situation you find yourself in? What is the next right step for you in our community here? What is the next right step for our community as a whole? Those are the sorts of things that bring about transformation when you start asking these sorts of questions. When you just sort of go on like autopilot, you don't think about things, you just move from the next thing to the next thing. What if we actually ask these kind of questions? Am I stagnant? And if I'm stagnant, where and why? And what's just the next right step to sort of break me out of those old stagnant patterns of seeing? Perhaps maybe we should ask, what's the next right step in your life with God? Is there an image of God as sort of a violent being up in the sky that just needs to die so that you can actually experience the God Jesus talks about? The God who isn't angry and disapproving of you, but the God who loves you and says, you're my child. The God who isn't up there bippity-boppity-booing at times, but the God who's around here. Like, if you take a deep breath, God is with you in the same way, right? That's how Jesus experienced God. Maybe there's a conception of God that just needs to be left in the past. A conception of church that just needs to be left in the past. A conception of how you treat your enemies that just needs to be left in the past so that we can experience the full, beautiful, life-giving moment we have actually been fortunate to get. You and I have been given a gift, and it's now. What would it look like to just take the right next step in the now? When we talk about our mission as a church, what we're talking about is this movement. moving from the one step to the next step to the next step, and growing and transforming the entire way. Are you with me? Let's pray. We open ourselves this morning. We open our hands. We open our hearts. Give us the courage to open our eyes and our ears. And perhaps give us the courage to close our mouths when they need to be closed and open when they need to be opened. Whatever is in us that is stagnant, may it be given new life to just move forward one step. Whatever is in us that needs to be healed and reconciled, if there's a relationship that's broken that we need to have a posture of openness to, give us eyes to see and ears to hear. And may we realize this world, this beautiful, crazy, hurting, joyful world, is the place where we've been invited to partner with God and with each other to do good. May we take that seriously. May we be a part of the movement. And may we never be the same because of it. I pray this in the name of Jesus, and everybody said, and let's stand together.